The city runs at a different speed than any other place. It has its own sound. It has its own look. The people there have their own look and style. You know what I mean? The people in New York look like just passerbys on the street look different than the people who are in Los Angeles.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today's episode is another investigation into what we learn and don't learn about places by watching movies about them. You might recall back in episode 263, I talked about this in the context of Kansas, my home state, and how the movies that have been set there over the years have tended to mythologize and misrepresent the place that exists in real life. And you can find my feature-length video essay on that topic, Kansas Never Plays Itself, at my Rolf Potts YouTube channel, or online at rolfpotts.com/Kansas. I've also embedded it in the show notes. Today I talk with movie critic Jason Bailey about what movies that are set in New York say about New York. Jason is the author of the book Fun City Cinema, which explores the history of movies that have been set and shot in New York City. He also writes about movies for venues like the New York Times, and he's written books about the movies of Woody Allen and Richard Pryor. You might recall way back in episode 69 of Deviate, Jason and I talked about the movie Pulp Fiction in the context of a book he wrote about that movie. In addition to being an expert on New York City cinema, Jason also happens to be a Kansas native. He and I attended the same high school in Wichita, 4 years apart, and back in the day he shot his own movies in Wichita before moving to New York 20 years ago to become a film critic. Together, we talk about why movies that were set in New York were actually shot in Los Angeles for the first half of the 20th century. We talk about the way dramatic movies end up becoming accidental documentaries about the places where they were shot. We talk about the way many young filmmakers from provincial places, Jason included, make movies that pretend they aren't local to those places. We talk about why you can't truly be aware of the diversity of a place if your social circle there is limited to wealthy or middle-class people. We start by talking about why, as a travel writer, I felt I needed to talk to a film critic to better understand this topic, and how annual TV screenings of The Wizard of Oz back in the day came to represent what Jason calls the Super Bowl of classic movies in the waning days of American monoculture. Let's listen in. So, Jason, I invited you specifically to talk about how cinema evokes sense of place. For the past year, I've gone down this rabbit hole that resulted in my video essay, Kansas Never Plays Itself, which is really from the perspective of a travel writer, since sense of place is my business. And I wanted to talk to film critics about this, and you're the perfect film critic with whom to talk about this, not just because your book, Fun City Cinema, is about sense of place in the context of New York, but I first knew you, Jason, as a Kansas filmmaker, and I'm not sure if people recognize that that's where your career started. So as a film critic who's from Kansas, I'm going to start with a softball question. As a film critic, when you tell them where they're from, do they say you're not in Kansas anymore?
I would say about 70% of the time, yeah, I get you get some sort of a Dorothy reference, but usually that one, yes. The rest of the time, it's usually just shock. It's like, oh, that's a very different situation than you're in now. And it really is. Like, I've lived two places in my life. I lived in Wichita, Kansas for the first 30 years, and in New York and its, you know, boroughs for the next 20. And so that usually gets, you know, some sort of a reaction as well. But, you know, you're right in that the idea of Kansas is very much, if it's not directly quoting Wizard of Oz, it is an idea of it that is sort of born out of that movie and its representation, such as it is, of the state. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I can be anywhere in the world, and I tell people where I'm from, and it's the only thing. The Wizard of Oz is the only thing they know about this. And you're one of a class of people who have come from the provinces to live in New York. And I think Joan Didion famously talked about, you know, New York is a, well, she said New York is a place for the wealthy and the young. You're no longer young. I don't think you're wealthy, so congratulations.
Nope. Thanks.
But I just wonder, when she said that she was from Sacramento, like, what did people say to her? Like,
right.
It feels pretty unique that Kansas, there are a few places that are more strongly associated with one movie than Kansas is to The Wizard of Oz. Can you think of any other associations?
In terms of specificity of one movie to one place? No. I mean, it's like everything else, you know, all of the other places you sort of associate have a ton of movies that are there. You know, your Chicago's, your L.A.'s, your San Francisco's, your... I think probably the closest, which you pinpointed in the video essay, is, you know, filmmakers who are sort of tied to their place of birth and rearing and so forth. So, like, you know, we do sort of, or I at least immediately associate Richard Linklater with Austin. I always associate Robert Rodriguez with Austin. I associate Paul Thomas Anderson with the Valley. Like, you know, sort of, so some of those sort of filmmakers that that speak a lot to their region or to their city, but those are usually spread out over multiple films. You know, I think about the only one that does make sense is, you know, Lady Bird to Sacramento, and it hasn't had quite as much time to sort of implant itself in the popular consciousness the way that The Wizard of Oz has.
Yeah, I wonder if Sacramento people have to answer to Lady Bird, or, I mean, Minnesotans have to answer to Fargo in a way, and probably...
That's true. That's another good example. Yeah, well, I mean, it also, though, you know, the ubiquity of Wizard of Oz, I don't think is replicable, you know, to a Lady Bird or to any kind of a contemporary film, just because that movie its ubiquity is such a product of a monoculture that's no longer with us. You know, it's not just that everyone has seen Wizard of Oz. It's why everyone has seen Wizard of Oz. That it had that run of, what, 50 years where it showed on CBS once a year. It was a giant event. It got huge ratings. It was the Super Bowl of, you know, of classic movies, that every, you know, the whole family would gather around the TV that one night. You know, I think it was usually around Easter, but I could be remembering that incorrectly, when they would do their annual airing of The Wizard of Oz, and it would be a big deal. So there are not a lot of contemporary movies that have that kind of, that make that kind of a mass imprint on the culture the way that this one did through that very specific venue.
Yeah, I think this conversation might bend towards the end of the monoculture and what happens after the monoculture is gone.
Right.
But truly, I mean, even speaking of new technologies, they have that AI version of The Wizard of Oz in the Sphere in Las Vegas.
Right.
I don't know if you know anything about that. I know very little about it.
I know a little bit. And one of my very good friends is Alyssa Wilkinson, who's one of the film critics for The Times. And she went to that and wrote a really terrific piece about it. But yeah, I mean, you know, how many movies that are set anywhere could you put in a venue like that and expect to, like, you know, to draw an audience, to have a commonality of experience that would make people want to go do that?
Well, having read Alyssa's article, I think she says that a lot of Kansas is chopped out. It's a shorter movie.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
And not wanting to see the ceiling of Dorothy's house for 15 minutes.
Right.
A lot of that stuff gets cut out.
Yeah.
So let's go back to you as a, I mean, do your colleagues like Alyssa or other film critics know that you were started as a filmmaker, or is that a part of your past that is not really a part of your public record anymore?
It's not like I keep it a deep, dark secret or anything. There is a part of me that I don't talk about it often. I will bring it up, but I don't talk about it often for two reasons. First of all, this is a tricky thing about our business, is that I know a few other film critics who started as filmmakers as well. Bilge Abiri at Vulture has made some films. Richard Brody at The New Yorker made some films. But there, it feeds into a not flattering misconception that film critics are sort of bitter failed filmmakers who are like taking out their fallen dreams on those who have managed to make a go of it. The other thing too is that I'm sort of half afraid that like people are going to go watch those movies, which I'm not ashamed of them, but they are certainly the movies I made when I was in my 20s, didn't know much what I was doing. There are a couple of them that I don't mind and that I'll even watch occasionally for nostalgia. But I do fear that if I talk about it too much, then people are going to go arm themselves with knowledge of my failures.
Well, actually, they're a little bit hard to find because when I was researching Kansas Never Plays Itself, I was looking for some of your old stuff as an example of local filmmakers and what they were doing, and I couldn't find very much that's available. So you've been able to hide your past, Jason.
Yay!
I mean, there could be an argument for the fact that maybe all film critics should try to make a movie just so they sort of know what they're seeing when they're seeing a movie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's necessary for everyone, and there are certainly also counter arguments that are persuasive. The famous quote when someone accused Pauline Kael of not knowing what she was talking about because she'd never made a movie was that, I don't have to lay an egg to know that my breakfast was terrible. I'm paraphrasing it poorly, but it's something along those lines. Like, there are, from a critical perspective, it can be helpful. It could also be harmful. And, like I said, I think it makes me a softer touch, and maybe that makes me a lesser critic. Maybe I should be able to approach it with complete objectivity, and not the sort of that inherent sympathy for the entire process. I don't know. It's a tough and tricky conundrum.
Well, I'm less interested in that conundrum actually for the purpose of this conversation than for what it was like to be a Wichita filmmaker, hidden as your old body of work is, which is
sure.
Fine.
Sure.
I'm going to betray my knowledge of your body of work just because as a young man, also in his 20s at the time, who went to the same high school as you in Wichita, mm-hmm. I sort of watched your Wichita movies with a fascination, a mix of fascination and jealousy. It's like, wow, you can do that in Wichita? And so how did Wichita work as a constraint? Because I think you have a movie like My Day in the Barrel. Nobody mm-hmm. will have seen this. It's one of your old movies. I knew about it because a friend of mine was in it, which is very much a Wichita movie. And there's almost a class specificity to My Day in the Barrel. But then you had a short called Heaven Sucks, which it feels like is supposed to be in a New York type city. It only shows the parts of Wichita that look like high rises and
right.
urban type places. So as a guy who, before you made your pilgrimage and eventual life in New York, how did Wichita affect the stories that you were telling?
I mean, the problem was that this isn't specific to film, I think this happens with fiction writers, with, visual artists, with musicians. You start out, your first few completed or incomplete projects are going to be you just imitating what you like. It takes that process, I think, of, imitation and homage, and ultimately usually failure at it, to sort of figure out your voice, your style, who you are as an artist. And so the first, the handful of the first films I made, the four features we made before My Day in the Barrel, which is my fifth film, but I think of it as my first film. It's the first real film. The first four features, which are all sort of shot on video, budgets of, $500 or less, were all me trying to be, Quentin Tarantino or Woody Allen or David Mamet or the filmmakers that I admired. And so they're all these sort of like, crime pictures, twisty mysteries, thrillers, nothing that is terribly specific to Wichita. I hadn't figured out how to make... I was so busy making movies that I was trying to pretend like we're not local. Because I don't know if you recall, but there's not a huge amount of organized crime happening in Wichita, Kansas. There are not a lot of, con men and private eyes, floating around in the bars of Wichita, Kansas, or at least not that I knew of. So those early films are imitation. The with Beryl somewhat, and then with the last feature that I made there, which was a film that we did in 2008, I think was when we premiered it there, called Gracie Rose. Those films were sort of consciously localized. That was me reaching a point where I didn't feel like I needed to try to be anyone else, and that I didn't need to try to, and that the movie didn't need to try to be anywhere else.
Well, it occurs to me, Jason, that there's probably a Los Angeles Plays Itself type collage essay film in the found footage of a bunch of 20-something filmmakers making videos of action movies in where they lived. Like, I'm sure,
right,
just in Wichita, probably in, you know, Fort Wayne and in Bellevue, Washington, there were probably a lot of people making gangster movies,
yep,
or making action movies. And if you found all that found footage, that would be an interesting essay film, you know, about how young people feel compelled to eliminate sense of place because they think movies are about places like New York, or if it's in west of the Mississippi, it should be about the Wild West, right?
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, and honestly, the main value, I was thinking about this last night after I watched your film, the main value that those early movies have for me, if and when I do go back and look at them, is really just as accidental documentaries of my college life, because this is pre-camera phones, whatever. I don't have a lot of photographs of the different apartments that I lived in throughout college and my immediate post-collegiate years, of the places where I worked in that time. But we were always making a movie. We made at least one movie every year. So everywhere I lived and everywhere I worked, we shot something there. So I can, if nothing else, you know, I can go back to and enjoy those movies for their backgrounds more than anything else. And that, in a weird way, was sort of the guiding principle that led me to some of the sort of big thesis and ideas of Fun City Cinema, of the New York project, was, you know, whenever I was sort of asked to sum up what the book was saying, the kind of the big idea of the book is that because New York is what it is, every contemporaneously set movie that was shot on location in New York is an accidental documentary of the city at that time. Like, there will be a narrative happening in the foreground, but there's a documentary happening in the background, that it's capturing that city at that moment in time, and maybe not for much longer because the city changes so frequently.
Well, in travel writing adjacent worlds, that's salvage anthropology, right? You know, that the documentary filmmakers who shot in the South Pacific in the 19-teens and 1920s, we're sort of shooting breathless movies about, air quotes, cannibals.
Right.
But after all these years, despite of how they may have misrepresented those cultures, they're showing life ways that don't exist anymore. And it feels like, you pointed this out in Fun City Cinema, that you watch Taxi Driver or, I don't know, Sweet Smell of Success or whatever, and you're seeing a New York that is gone. And I think Tom Anderson talks about this a little bit in Los Angeles Plays Itself.
Sure.
That can be a window. And just so my listeners know, Los Angeles Plays Itself was very much a guidance for my own Kansas Never Plays Itself, because he sort of explores cinema, just how his own city is evoked in cinema.
Right.
And actually, he takes issue with a lot of specifics about the way Los Angeles is portrayed. And I think if one is a Kansan, it's like, well, at least you're being portrayed, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, at least you have these specific examples, and you have this sort of wealth of material, you know, that you can draw from. Yeah.
Well, I want to jump into your relationship to the other pole of your life, which is New York, where you've lived for a long time, and it's where you're raising your family. And it's, you know, it was the subject of Fun City Cinema. And so one thing I learned from that book was how few New York films were shot in New York between 1910 and about 1960.
Right.
So for the purpose of my listeners understanding this, I think an instinct is, if you're from Fort Wayne or Boise or Wichita, then you think, well, at least New York is getting portrayed. Well, actually, the New York was a soundstage New York. So why don't you give us a little explainer on why New York movies were shot on sound stages in Los Angeles for 50 years, and how that may have affected the evocation of that city.
Right. Well, so, you know, the American filmmaking scene, for all intents and purposes, began in New York or the New York area. There were a few other, you know, smaller cities in Jersey that were, but, you know, all in the basically the tri-state area. But, you know, Edison was here. There were, you know, studios, smaller studios that sort of popped up here. And a lot of the first films that were made in America were these movies that were called actualities, which really were, it was before anyone was really even attempting narrative storytelling, even in a short film form. These were just movies that would, you know, they would just be called like, you know, Herald Square, 5 p.m. And it would just be like what we think of now as an establishing shot, you know, just sort of a panning shot of New York life for 2 minutes. And that would be the entire movie. And so a lot of the early American movies are just these, you know, New York actualities. They had to shoot all of those outdoors, or, you know, eventually they started rigging up to where they would shoot on rooftops. And sometimes they would, you know, and then eventually they figured out, you know, oh, we can put, you know, sort of softening filter, you know, they would set up these sort of outdoor studios, but it was an imperfect solution because New York is a normal city with normal weather. They sort of discovered that, hey, if you're out in California, they have sunny skies year round. The rain is less infrequent. Snow like never happens. It's warm and you can shoot outside. And in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, in this area that they were sort of starting to settle for motion picture production, you were 20 minutes from a beach. You were 20 minutes from the desert. Like, you know, that there was a lot more variety of location available. So that you could sort of have whatever backdrops you needed to tell your story. And so that was what drove the sort of initial move westward for the motion picture industry. As time passed, it became so centralized there that it became extremely difficult to mount motion pictures on the East Coast. One of the things that I always remember that when I had the wonderful and very brief opportunity to interview Martin Scorsese for the book was he told me that they would, when they were watching, you know, when he would be with his friends in the, you know, the movie house on Saturday watching movies, and they would see a movie that took place in New York, they would know as kids that wasn't actually shot there, because he would say the curbs were the wrong height or the street lamps were wrong. You know, that there were specificities to New York that were sort of citywide that they didn't go to the trouble to replicate when they were manufacturing those backlots. And then the other sort of factor that came into play too was just that it was a bureaucratic nightmare. The way that motion picture production had been set up at that time was that, you know, if a filmmaker wanted to make a movie in New York, they had to apply for individual permits for every single location that they wanted to shoot at. They'd have multiple permits. They had to reach out to the police. They had to pay police presence. They usually had to bribe cops as well. You know, that was like often a line item. But, you know, it was just a nightmare of red tape for someone to come to New York and make a movie here. And so all of those factors sort of came into play and were the reason that, like you say, for most of the first half century of sort of popular mainstream movie making, there were very few movies that were shot sort of entirely, at least, within New York or the five boroughs.
What do you reckon was lost in movies that had an establishing shot and then a bunch of indoor shots, and this can apply to any locations. I mean, many Kansas Westerns were, Kansas movies were Westerns, you know, which were shot on the lot. And so let's think about, you know, how sense of place is evoked and what is lost when you have the backlog standing in for New York.
Right. I mean, you know, that it's, there is a, and it's hard to even put into words sometimes because it is just, it's imperceptible. There's just a feeling that you get when you are in New York or Austin, Texas, or New Orleans, or any of the other sort of distinctive American cities. There is a sense of place. There is a feeling. There's a vibe, for lack of a better word. the city runs at a different speed than any other place. It has its own sound. It has its own look. The people there have their own look and style. You know what I mean? The people in New York look like just passerbys on the street look different than the people who are in Los Angeles, you know, who are suntanned and in much better health. They're eating better. They're experiencing better weather. So, you know, and what is fascinating about a lot of the sort of, say, you know, the New York set films noir of the 1940s and 50s, they want to capture that specific big city New York feel, the speed with which things move, the slanginess of it, the energy of it. And you can only go so far to replicate that on a soundstage. And you can, even if you don't know that The Naked City was shot entirely here, when you watch it, you know, if you watch it back to back with a New York set noir, you know, something like, you know, the City That Doesn't Sleep, or where, you know, there are Fritz Lang movies, you know, things like that. If you watch it in, you know, back to back with New York set noirs that were shot in Los Angeles, you can tell right away. It moves at a different speed. It has a different sound. It has a different look.
One interesting thing that you bring up in the book is that at about the time that filmmaking technology caught up with the ability to shoot in the streets, it coincided with a pretty crappy time in New York's history.
Right, right. In sort of major motion pictures, what is dramatic is conflict. I mean, that's the essence of drama is conflict. And so the films that were made were sort of emphasizing that, and whether that conflict came, you know, in terms of class conflict, whether it came in terms of crime, you know, those were the stories that were sort of to be told at that particular moment. It was not all of them, you know, but all, you know, a movie like Fame, for example, you know, is an honest portrait of New York circa 1980. That's also about, you know, look how cool it is to be a young person, you know, who wants to be an artist and is living here. And, you know, and also they didn't necessarily, all the films didn't necessarily reflect all of the city as they saw it. You know, through this entire period that I'm talking about, you've also got Woody Allen making, you know, movies set on the Upper East Side in, you know, really sort of wealthy or upper middle class at the very least circles, and presenting a portrait of the city that is very much removed from the kind of crime and grime that you see in a lot of the other movies of the era. So it's multifaceted. Which I, not to go all the way back to what we were originally talking about, but, you know, you had a lot of different pictures of New York to choose from, as opposed to just the Wizard of Oz picture of Kansas.
Well, I'm curious about that in an evocation of Kansas, sort of bending things back to Kansas and, you know, just the idea that conflict drives narrative. One, I'm curious to know if you have any favorite Kansas movies. But I'm just sort of curious about... Part of the argument here is permission to tell multiple stories about one place. Because even in Wichita, I think one reason why I sort of appreciated the Wichita movies you were making back in the 90s is that you're a North Wichita guy, and that's different than East Wichita, you know?
Right.
Different from South Wichita. And so I think sometimes we forget that, well, yeah, that Kansas isn't just Kansas. It's a place about the size of England. Mm-hmm. And our two most famous Kansas actors went to the same high school in Shawnee Mission, like 8 miles from the Missouri border. And so within a given film scene, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's Wichita people who don't think Wichita is a diverse place simply because they haven't hung out with people who aren't wealthy, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah, and so how does this, keeping in mind, you know, New York sort of... became this place to escape in cinema in the 1970s, including Escape from New York, which was not shot in New York.
Of course.
Kansas is also a place of escape. Dorothy wants to be someplace else, right? Superman's real story happens in Metropolis. And so I am curious if you have a favorite Kansas movie. You can say you have none if you want, but then how do places like Kansas, how are they subject to these rules that didn't really pop in New York until the 1970s of being able to capture something? You said movies about real life. Mm-hmm. What's the conundrum with a place like Kansas about movies that are about real life?
I mean, the problem is that, you know, with occasional exceptions, it's hard to convince people that they want to see a movie about people in a place that they don't know anything about and have no notion of. You know, as a Kansas kid, I'm fascinated by New York. So I want to watch all of these New York movies. But is a New York kid at all interested in Kansas? Well, you know, maybe not. But the point that you make about the sort of specificity of that place, I think is only possible if you've got a diverse wealth of filmmakers from different areas with different experiences telling different stories. And you see that in New York, and you see that in Los Angeles, and you see that in Austin even. But you don't see that in a place like Wichita. And, you know, it's... And as a result... then someone coming up like me doesn't have a sense of a sort of a Wichita filmmaking tradition that they need to fall in, that they can take inspiration from or fall into. And instead, we just end up making movies about what we think life would be like in the cities that we do see movies about. And it's, you know, and it becomes a sort of a vicious circle, I think.
Maybe you can help me think just as sort of a thought experiment of how technology might affect how places are evoked in movies, because I think it's easier to shoot movies, you know, fast and dirty in real places. It's easier for young people like you were in the 1990s to shoot movies about their home places. But I wonder if there will always be movie industry towns that sort of dictate how stories are told about various places. And if AI... I'm just going to throw a bunch at you, Jason, because I read an article recently about how film school students often don't watch feature-length movies anymore.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. You have technology that allows way more options for filmmakers, but it also includes AI, which is anti-place.
Right.
And then you have these young people who have lived lives less beholden to place because they can see the world through their phones. And they also are used to reels that last 90 seconds or YouTube videos that last, I don't know, 10 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. And so I guess embedded in this is cinema going to be different in another couple generations?
I mean, I think, I don't know how much different. I feel like there is an evolution, I'm 50 years old, so I'm allowed to be a little more cynical about this sort of thing. I feel like there is an evolution that has been slow motion happening since the 90s, since we were, you know, since I was trying to make movies. And the evolution being that there really are two industries, you know, that the... you know, big budget studio filmmaking and independent bespoke, you know, handmade filmmaking are, you know, that some filmmakers start in one and cross over to the other. Some stay here, some stay here. But at a certain point, we became so enamored with, you know, chasing the tent pole, chasing the blockbuster, making $1 billion worldwide on a movie, that the sort of the compartments that existed for movies in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s kind of evaporated. Now, what I think / hope is the case is that void, that kind of no risk, big budget only model leaves, that is going to leave room for independent filmmakers to fill that. You know, that there will be a hunger, especially among adults, for movies that are not IP plays, tentpole movies, superhero things, and an audience that has increased, that has shown from the 1980s, you know what I mean? This from Jim Jarmusch and Spike Lee on, from hell, go back to Cassavetes on. If people are hungry enough for films that are a recognizable reality, that are telling stories about people like them, then they will overlook small technical flaws. They will overlook those imperfections that come with a low budget if a movie is speaking to them about something that is recognizable and real. And I think we're just going to kind of see a continuation of that divide, whatever forms those perspective pockets take on, whether it's, you know, influence, whether it's AI or whether it's, you know, the expansion of budgets or whatever it may be in this case. And then for the smaller movies, as it gets easier and less expensive to make things that look professional. You know, a movie you can make on your iPhone right now looks and sounds better than the movie that it cost us $7,000 to make on 16 millimeter in 1998. You know, and is a hell of a lot easier for them to cut than, you know, than when we had to edit that movie on a Media 100 computer on the WSU campus and had to do it in quarters because that was all the hard drive space we could afford at a time. You know, as the technology improves, hopefully the professionalism, quote unquote, will allow low budget filmmakers to work in ways that make sense to them and in ways that are possible for them, and then to bring it back around, that entail that in turn means making movies where they are that are about who they are and where they come from.
And I wonder, that's a great point. I could even leave the interview there, but is generational attention span going to be an issue? Because I looked at the stats for my video essay, and over 90% of the viewers are 45 or above. Now, it's a cerebral video essay about the history and sense of place. But like, I've read about microdramas coming out of China that are 90 seconds long. They're serialized. They're very pulpy. They're very genre-driven. But I just wonder if the technological specificity of a 90-minute feature film might be rarer in the future.
I mentioned that I'm 50 and it makes me cynical. It also allows me a little bit of optimism or nostalgia, or I don't know what exactly. I am of the opinion that feature filmmaking as we know it is too entrenched, is too much the status quo for it to be sort of shed and dismissed. I think we are 100 plus years into feature filmmaking, and I don't think it's going anywhere. Now, will it become more specialized? Will it become rarer? That I can't speak to. You know, I can say, you know, classical concertos have been around for hundreds of years. They're not going anywhere. Yeah, but they're writing and performing fewer of them now. Mm-hmm. And maybe that'll turn out to be the case. Maybe it will turn out to be a more specialized thing. Maybe going to the movies will become more like going to the theater in terms of frequency and or in terms of cost. That's all possible, and I don't put any of that aside. But I think there are enough... The history of feature filmmaking is rich enough, and there are enough people who love feature films of all ages, you know what I mean? That there will always at least be some interest in telling stories in that way and some interest in seeing stories in that way.
All right, final question. I want to tie it back to my thesis, which is how place is evoked in cinema. What does this portend to evocations of place? Do you think that sort of the bifurcation of film will always sort of have a soundstagey aspect to how places are evoked? Or is this renaissance of independent filmmaking going to make the Kansases of the world, you know, more three-dimensional than they have been historically?
I think very much the latter. And I think especially because, thank you for coming back to this, because this was a point that crossed my brain earlier that I forgot to make, especially as you're seeing the big budget tentpole IP, et cetera, all of the sort of pejoratives that I've used, especially as you're seeing that kind of filmmaking become so impersonal, not just in terms of personality and storytelling, but in terms of place. Like the way that you can track where Marvel movies are made based on who's giving them the best tax incentive. you know, by the fact that, like, I think I read somewhere that, like, that, the, you know, sort of the next wave of them are going to be shot in London because, you know, that's where they can make them with, that's where they can get the best tax incentives. Where we had years before that of all of this production being based in Atlanta, you know, but none of these movies are set in Atlanta. None of them feel like Atlanta because they're all being shot against green screens there, you know? So I think the sort of, the impersonality that is part and parcel of big budget filmmaking now, that is, and that impersonality, which is sort of built into just going for the largest audience you can, that location and place is built into that. You know, that these are all movies that feel like they were made by a committee, and they're all movies that feel like they could have been made anywhere. And because of the ubiquity of sort of behind the scenes stuff and whatever, when we're watching them, we're aware that they were made anywhere. We're aware that we're watching, you know, Spider-Man against a green screen in Atlanta somewhere. Like, so I feel like in addition to all of the virtues that I mentioned of, you know, sort of handmade, independent, low budget iPhone filmmaking, a sense of place is going to be built into that. You know, I think a lot of filmmakers, hopefully sooner than I did, will come to the realization that the place that they live is a unique production value that no one else can get. And the sense they have of that place is something they have that no other filmmaker does. And if they're smart, again, hopefully before I did, they will work that into what they're doing. And that that sense of place will become part of the movies. And you see it. I mean, it's, you know, there's a vibrant film scene in Austin, Texas, and all of those movies feel like Austin. You know, the when you were seeing kind of the mumblecore movement coming out of Brooklyn in the, you know, the aughts, those movies all felt like Brooklyn. You know, these pockets of regional filmmakers, these communities of filmmakers, they are often smart enough to know that this is a specific value that their movies have, and they take great pains to put that into the work. And people can feel that and will respond to that, I think.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Jason Bailey's book Fun City Cinema, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.